Today is September the 8th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, that's the Progressive Radio Network, streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Broadcasters call anti-locast ruling a victory for copyright laws. Big broadcasters responded with relief last Wednesday to a judge's ruling that the day before, granting an injunction against television streaming app Locast, that's L-O-C-A-S-T, from transmitting their local TV streams to customers. The lawyers for the plaintiffs said in a statement on behalf of ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC that the federal court's ruling is a victory for copyright law, vindicating their claim that Locast is illegally infringing copyrights in broadcast television content in violation of federal law. They will now seek a permanent injunction to stop Locast copyright infringement of the programming that the broadcasters and their partners work to create. Previously, the four major U.S. broadcast networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox, have emerged victorious in lawsuit against Locast, a nonprofit that enables local TV streams. The plaintiffs, in this case, of course, the stations, asked the judge to throw out Locast's claim that its online service is legally exempt from copyright infringement liability because it only seeks donations, not fees from users, and only enough to keep its business running. Locast wanted a finding that it is exempt. Plaintiff's motion for partial summary judgment is granted, and defendant's motion for summary judgment is denied, wrote Judge Lewis Stanton of the Southern District of New York in a ruling last week on Tuesday. Locast users pay it a minimum $5 monthly fee in exchange for a month-long uninterrupted service, which the judge refused to categorize as merely a recurring gift to a charitable cause. $5 is not a big deal. Locast still solicits and receives substantial amounts and charges from recipients for its uninterrupted service. Locast argues that its funding model qualifies for the statutory exemption because payments from users are reinvested in the organization to cover costs of maintaining and operating an expanding system. The judge noted that in 2020, Locast made far more money from user charges that was necessary to defray its costs of maintaining and operating its service. The judge additionally said that Locast has also been expanding into new markets, but under the statute, income made from charges to recipients can only be used to defray the actual and reasonable cost of maintaining and operating the service, not of expanding it into new markets. Backers of Locast, which was founded in 2018, say it is adhering to copyright laws, which permit boosters of local broadcast signals, which are designed to secure the accessibility of broadcast signals. Locast, a nonprofit streaming service that pipe local broadcast signals over the Internet, is shutting down after a federal judge ruled against the organization in a rare case tackling the legality of network content delivered online. The organization said it was suspending operations effective immediately, and it added that Locast was meant to operate in accordance with a strict letter of the law, but had to comply with a ruling which it disagreed. Locast was created by a public service for people who want to watch their local broadcast TV stations, but could not get them over the air, and cannot afford expensive cable, satellite, or streaming services. Locast was set up to take advantage of provisions in the law that gives people free access to network telecasts and includes exemptions for nonprofits. Apple hits pause on controversial CSAM detection feature. As reported recently, Apple had announced that it had intended to help protect children from predators who use communication tools to recruit and exploit them and limit the spread of child sexual abuse material. After backlash from security experts and based on feedback from customers, advocacy groups, researchers, and others, Apple has decided to take additional time over the coming months to collect input and make improvements before releasing these critically important child safety features. Early last month, Apple announced it would introduce a new set of tools to help detect known child sexual abuse material, known as CSAM, in photos stored on iPhones. The feature was criticized by security experts as a violation of user privacy, and what followed was a major public relations nightmare for Apple. Now, in a rare move, Apple said it's going to take a step back to further refine the feature before public release. Last month, they announced plans for features intended to help protect children from predators who use communication tools to recruit and exploit them and limit the spread of child sexual abuse material. Based on feedback from customers and advocacy groups and researchers and others, they have decided that they really got to step back and rethink this and try to come up with improvements before releasing these critically important child safety features. Initially, CSAM features were set to roll out with iOS 15 later this fall. However, the backlash was fierce, with thousands signing an open letter to Apple asking them to rethink the feature. Internally, Apple employees were also reported to have raised concerns. While critics agreed that child pornography is a serious problem, the fear was that Apple had essentially built a backdoor in users' iPhones that could be easily abused to scan for other materials. Doing so could lead foreign governments to potentially use a tool intended for noble purposes as a means of surveillance and censorship. There were also concerns that innocent photos of children in bathtubs may be flagged as child porn. Yet another fear was that the tools could be used as a workaround for encrypted communications. Apple initially doubled down, releasing lengthy FAQs and hosting several briefings with reporters to clarify how the features worked and the company's intent. However, what algorithms they're using was not made publicly available. The company also tried to allay fears by promising that it wouldn't allow governments to abuse its CSAM tools as a surveillance weapon. However, when asked if a foreign government asked them to do it, they just responded that they would work with a foreign government. And despite all its best efforts, most people remain confused as to how the CSAM feature really works and the risk it imposed to individual privacy. As of right now, Apple has offered few clues as to when it now plans to roll out the feature or what its revision process would look like. Amazon is reportedly making its own TVs. Amazon-branded televisions are rumored to be launched as early as October. Amazon may be moving from streaming boxes to actual Amazon-branded TVs. According to an insider report, the company is now preparing to launch its own Amazon-branded televisions, possibly as soon as October. Insider claims that the televisions will have Alexa built in and be somewhere in the range of 55 to 75 inches. The TV will also supposedly be designed and manufactured by TCL. Who is TCL? TCL has built a reputation for making an abundance of affordable TVs. In 2017, the Chinese brand became the third biggest brand in North America, and its LCD TV sales are, according to the company, growing rapidly year on year as they become increasingly available in the UK and other European countries. The TV launch has been kept secret internally within Amazon, but that the company has been at this project for nearly 2 years, it also reportedly involves teams from both Amazon devices and Lab 126, the research and development team behind the Kindle and the Fire TV Stick. It's unclear whether these TVs will have Fire TV software like other Fire TVs currently sold by other manufacturers. However, there's a good reason to think it will. Amazon updated Fire TV user interface late last year, and around the same time, it also launched two TVs under the Amazon Basics brand in India. Additionally, Amazon's entry into gadgets have historically been as a means to embed its services into people's homes. There is the Alexa microwave, Echo frames, and the original Echo speakers. As for price, Amazon's primarily known for being affordable. The TV at launch in India, for example, cost roughly $410 for the 50-inch model and $480 for the 55-inch model. The Insignia-branded Fire TV sold at Best Brand are also dirt cheap and feature prominently in Amazon Prime Day sales. What remains to be seen is whether these rumored TVs are meant to serve the budget market or whether Amazon actually plans to compete with other TV manufacturers like Sony, LG, and Samsung, or whether it'll promote its own TVs at the expense of others sold on its online marketplace. While the rollout could be as early as next month, it is reported that the project has been impacted by logistic bottlenecks given the global chip shortage, which has led to delays and supply issues. Hopefully, we probably won't have to wait too long to find out if this is happening at all. October is just around the corner, and Black Friday is not too far behind. Windows 11. Microsoft giveth, and Microsoft taketh away. When Microsoft originally announced Windows 11, it was quickly discovered that Microsoft had made some drastic changes to the system requirements. Most importantly, there are some strict requirements on which CPUs are supported by the new operating system. When it came down to testing in the Windows Insider program, however, the Redmond firm wasn't quite as strict. Here's how it worked. If you were in the development channel prior to the announcement, you'd be allowed to stay up until Windows 11 comes out. Once it's out, you have to roll back to Windows 10 or you'll be in an unsupported state, assuming your PC is ineligible. Obviously, if your PC is eligible, you're good to go. For beta channel insiders, they were kicked off of the beta channel and placed into release preview for Windows 10 21H2 testing. Microsoft has started kicking unsupported PCs out of the development channel of the Windows Insider program. If you're in the development channel and your CPU isn't on the supported list, you'll likely find that you have to go back to Windows 10 in order to keep receiving updates. The transition to the new system requirements haven't been an entirely smooth one, but there's a good reason that things are the way they are. Windows 10 versions 20H2, 21H1, and 21H2 are all enablement packages that build on top of version 2004. But since the spring of 2020, Microsoft still has been releasing pre-release builds in the development channel, with none of these features actually shipping in Windows 10. These pre-release builds eventually became Windows 11. That means when Microsoft decided on the new system requirements, it had to think of a solution for all the Windows insiders that wouldn't qualify for Windows 11, but were already running pre-release builds. After all, you can't deliver an update from build 20XXX to build 19XXX. The general rule is that if the build number goes down, you have to do a factory reset. Because of this, the Redmond company decided to let insiders on the development channel tag along for Windows 11 testing. Obviously, those users were used for telemetry when Microsoft said it would consider Intel's 7th generation and AMD Zen processors for Windows 11 support. It got to look at data from all of the insiders that were still able to run Windows 11. That's how the firm came up with stats saying that supported PCs had a 99.8% crash-free experience, while unsupported PCs had a 52% more crashes, which really only means that it's a 99.7% crash-free experience. But now, that run of testing has come to an end. It's never fun when you have to reset your PC, but that's the risk of the insider program. Many older PCs have been happily running the Windows 11 previews for months. Now, despite Microsoft's stringent official system requirements, that's about to change. It's been reported that some users of unsupported PCs are beginning to see a message telling them to reinstall Windows 10 when they attempt to enroll older PCs in the insider program after performing a clean install of the Windows 11 preview. Microsoft has made efforts to explain its reasoning for why old processors won't be officially supported by Windows 11, but it has added only a small handful of older chips to the original compatibility list it announced in June. If you've been happy with the performance of Windows 11 on your unsupported PC, and you like to install Windows 11 anyway, Microsoft won't go out of its way to prevent manual upgrades on older PCs, but the company has suggested it might withhold security updates from those PCs going forward. Like I said, when you do beta testing for Microsoft, you're doing it for free for Microsoft. And guess who benefits? Microsoft. And if you can no longer go to Windows 11 while you're on the insider program, well, you just perform a free service for Microsoft. Are we prepared for an internet apocalypse caused by the sun? The sun is entering a more active part of its 11-year solar cycle, as reported by spaceweather.com, that a solar tsunami occurred on the surface of the sun recently. A mass of charged solar particles hurtled towards us, and it could be joined by the leftovers of a solar flare to produce a G1 class geomagnetic storm. Our sun is waking up, and it could have devastating consequences, particularly in North America. If a black swan event like a solar superstorm occurs, we know the sun is getting more active as it enters a new solar cycle, with some predicting that it could be the strongest since records began. Earth will cope this time, but what about the 1.6% to 12% chance that a huge solar superstorm occurs? Are we prepared for such an event? North America is one of the most vulnerable regions where an outage of the internet could last for months. It's the subject of a new research published and presented at the SIGCOM 2021 Data Communications Conference, with internet outages estimated to cost about $7.2 billion per day to the U.S. economy. Of course, Earth does have defenses against solar flares. Intense bursts of radiation that only threatens our planet when they happen on the side of the sun facing it. When solar flares come our way, Earth's magnetic sphere accelerates the charged particles down its field lines to the poles. The result, of course, is an afterglow known as the aurora, the northern lights and southern lights. Corona mass ejections, known as CMEs, are different. Rarer, high eruptions on the sun caused by the magnetic storms, they create huge clouds of plasma that could damage power grids if they drift our way. However, power grids are designed to mitigate the effects of CMEs. The internet is not. The networking community has largely overlooked this risk during the design of network topology and geo-distributed systems such as DNS and data centers. The report predicts such an event would cause large-scale internet outages covering the entire globe and lasting several months. Would solar activity affect undersea cables? Undersea cables are the invisible backbone of the internet. While the fiber optic cables under countries and cities wouldn't suffer, largely because they're shorter and grounded, the vast number of subsea links between continents are more vulnerable. CMEs produce geomagnetically induced currents, that's GIC, on the Earth's surface through electromagnetic induction. Based on the strength of the CME, in extreme cases, GIC has the potential to enter and damage long-distance cables that constitute the backbone of the Internet. Long-distance cables have repeaters to boost the optical signals and spaced at intervals of 30 to 93 miles, which are powered using a conductor. Do we know if they're resilient to solar superstorms? No. The last large solar events were in 1859 and 1921, which damaged the telegraph network. As for the modern Internet, its resilience has not been tested. Why North America would suffer the most? Since the high-energy particles from a solar superstorm would be funneled towards the poles, the higher latitudes would be most at risk. This is where most Internet infrastructure is, including undersea cables. While Europe tends to use shorter cables, North America relies on longer cables, so North America could suffer longer Internet blackouts. Either way, Europe and America could become disconnected, while Asia's equatorial Singapore hub would likely be less effective. What about satellites? Satellites in orbit are also in danger of being damaged. That's potentially an even bigger deal in the future if systems like SpaceX Starlink Constellation succeeds in bringing low-cost broadband to much of the world who can't yet access the Internet. Starlink-style satellite networks might be especially vulnerable. GPS and communication satellites, which are directly exposed to solar storms, will suffer from lost connectivity during the event. Potential damage to electronic components and, in the worst case, orbital decay and re-entry to Earth, particularly in low Earth orbit satellites such as Starlink. In reflecting on how unprepared the world was for the coronavirus pandemic, there was no protocol to deal with it effectively, and this holds the same with Internet resilience. The report says our infrastructure is not prepared for a large-scale solar event. We have a very limited understanding of what the extent of the damage would be. 99% of international data is transmitted by undersea cables. Why the threat is now becoming real? All this comes as our sun waxes towards solar maximum in 2024. The sun has a cycle that lasts between 9 and 14 years, typically 11 years on average. At the peak of that cycle called solar maximum, the sun produces more electrons and protons as solar flares and CMEs. During the solar maxima, there is an increase in the frequency of two solar phenomena, solar flares and CMEs, both caused by contortions in the sun's magnetic fields, solar maximum and total solar eclipses. It's thought that the sun will reach solar maximum in the mid-2020s, though exactly when sunspot frequency will peak is anyone's guess. It's something that can usually only be described in retrospect. The last solar maximum was in 2013 and 2014, but that was ranked among the weakest on record. The next one could be the strongest. One way to engage what's going on visually is by counting sunspots, and the other is by looking at the sun's mighty corona during total solar eclipse. The next one is December the 4th, 2021 in Antarctica. If we believe the Internet is also critical infrastructure, and of course it is, it needs protecting against another kind of corona emergency. IBM mainframe applications ain't going away. For those working with mainframe applications, why they aren't going anywhere, and IBM i, previously known as OS 400, the operating system for IBM's power systems, has a long history and continues to be a mainstay in industries like banking, retail, manufacturing, distribution, and finance today. Despite its age, it will likely continue to be around for some time to come, as IBM has developed a full roadmap for the venerable operating system. This is all counter to the computing culture that one size fits all. In addition, the 2021 IBM i Marketplace Survey from Help Systems found that 73% of respondents use IBM i for over half of their core business applications, and 67% plan to either maintain or grow their existing IBM i footprint, showing strong customer interest. All this talk about mainframe applications or dinosaur applications needing migration is often just talk. Still, organizations will often talk about migrating away from the platform to reduce costs as part of a data center exit, or because the universe of IT pros who are experienced with it continues to dwindle. But that talk really translates into action due to a number of factors. First is customization. Many IBM i applications have been heavily customized over the years and would be very difficult to refactor without specialized solutions. The refactoring process would take years and have a decent risk of breaking important applications or undoing helpful customizations. The chances of this happening increase significantly if the engineers who worked on those applications through their lifetime are no longer at the company. And then with IBM i application, it's still easy to upgrade. Even applications written in the 1980s can run on the latest IBM Power hardware, providing a straightforward way to get performance boost without recoding or refactoring. And then there's complex migrations. Migrating an IBM i application onto another platform is complex, slow, and painful, taking anywhere from 3 to 5 years. In fact, it's so complex, some IBM i customers intent on migrating off the platform continue to invest in tools to monitor, manage, and secure it, even though those tools may be obsolete after the migration is completed. And then finally, there is inertia. IBM i applications tend to be decades or more old and crucial to business operations such as enterprise systems. IT often has an "if it isn't broken, don't fix it" attitude towards these systems, encouraged by the fact that IBM i engineer population is aging. This is enough of an issue that IBM launched a fresh face campaign to get more IT pros trained on the platform and to prevent a future skills shortage. IBM i also has some not inconsiderable advantages. For instance, it offers a number of mature high availability options that don't have equivalents on other platforms. These allow for row swaps between machines to ensure availability during upgrades, maintenance, application issues, or for disaster recovery. IBM i is also highly securable thanks to many features built into the operating system and many mature third-party tools and utilities. There are savings in staff as well. IBM i requires far fewer sysadmins to maintain than, say, an equivalent Windows Server implementation, so applications can be run with smaller IT teams. And finally, IBM i on Power is renowned for its survivability, which is why it is favored by industries like banking that prioritize resilience. Convincing these risk-averse organizations to gamble on an unfamiliar prospect, it's difficult at best. So, what is an enterprise to do if it wants to gain some of the benefits of cloud infrastructure without the cost, time, and potential disruption of refactoring IBM i applications? One option is to migrate IBM i applications to run natively as is in the public cloud. The amount of work required and the technology used for this vary based on the workload. For example, if no downtime is allowed, a logical replication tool can be used. If some downtime is possible, perhaps a save or restore tool is best. In most cases, a combination of the two will work. The cost of these tools and the work required is usually far less than the expense and risk of refactoring or re-architecturing, and are outweighed by the benefits of running the application in the cloud. To minimize risk, IT teams should first lift and shift existing IBM i applications to the cloud without changing them whatsoever. Create the same number of VMs, same memory disk CPU allocations, same file system structures, same exact IP addresses, same exact host names, same network subnets, etc. This preserves the benefit of IBM Power listed as noted, while allowing the organization to take advantage of pay-as-you-go pricing, plus discounts for committing to between 1 and 3 years upfront and cloud flexibility. It also minimizes risk during the migration. For many organizations, once you're in the cloud, replatforming doesn't make sense at all. If organizations do want to ultimately replatform out of the IBM power, they can now begin to replace their software with cloud-native equivalents piece by piece. For example, replacing an Oracle database with CosmoDB in Azure without touching the rest of the application. By lifting and shifting to the cloud first and replatforming at a controlled pace, the organization faces less risk overall. Problems start to happen when IT tries to do too much at once. But for many organizations, once you're in the cloud, replatforming doesn't make sense. Simply running the IBM i application in the cloud without replatforming or refactoring keeps many of the advantages of IBM i while allowing IT to enjoy the benefit of cloud flexibility. Not only will they save on costs, but IT will also have the capability to clone logical partitions, which allows IBM i to slot nicely into many DevOps disciplines while providing a modern alternative to high availability and disaster recovery. The reasons for staying with IBM Power are valid, and the future of the platform remains strong. But that doesn't mean that users are locked out of using the cloud. So, which is better? Operating with the best-of-breed platforms or an all-in-one platform type in which one size fits all? Well, you know the answer. It's the best-of-breed. A best-of-breed approach affords the opportunity to implement new solutions versus just the tools that are offered under the umbrella of certain providers. Custom technology makes it easier to remove or consolidate systems over time as the business requires. So when people are calling the mainframe as a dinosaur, it's still alive. It is still alive and thriving. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell. Hospitals with better information technology have fewer deaths.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we sit down for just a few minutes and we discuss how business and the interaction of computers and technology with the business impact us. Now, this goes back a number of years ago. This goes back before COVID, but there was a study that came out by the Archives of Internal Medicine. Now, initially, you're going to say this is a common sense thing, but I think this whole study actually unpacks a lot of information that is valuable to all of us in the business place. Everybody in the workplace really needs to understand this. The study went like this, and I'm going to make this, it's very simple. Hospitals that had better IT had fewer deaths. Boom. Right there. Real simple. Hospitals that spent more on information technology had fewer deaths. Hospitals that paid their IT people better. The hospitals with better IT people. The hospitals that went through and did a focus on information technology had fewer deaths. Now we think about this. We think about hospitals. Well, these should be the hospitals that spend more on doctors. These should be the hospitals that have the better doctors. These should be the hospitals that are at the cutting edge of the science of medicine that are having fewer deaths. And it's all tied together. I want you to think about this. This is all tied together. If you spend more money on IT, if you focus on IT and let your focus on IT trickle throughout your entire company, it's how you treat the nerds. It's how you treat the geeks. It's how you treat those guys who really are a cost center. This is how businesses think. Now, mind you, I don't think of IT as a cost center. IT is, of course, a supporter. IT is the idea department. They are the innovators. They are the people who are bringing new ideas and information and statistics and all of that to the workplace. You follow me there? So if we're putting that kind of effort and energy into what traditionally the numbers geeks, the finance geeks, what they think is a cost center, if they're willing to spend the money there, they're also willing to spend the money on the other things like the better doctors and so forth and so on. This is rampant throughout all industries, really. Everywhere that I have seen, companies that focus on information technology, whether we're talking about the statistics, whether we're talking about the servers, the better paying of IT workers, the better you treat them, the better the entire company runs. And we can say this applies in a number of different directions, but let's dive into just like the medical field. So much of a hospital is run on computers these days. Most patients who would possibly die are actually on life support, which is run by, oh yeah, computers. They're being monitored by computers. They're being administered pain meds through the computers. There's information sharing throughout via computers. Everywhere you turn. It's been a long time since I've been in the hospital. It's been probably about 14 years ago I went in and I had appendicitis. I went to a hospital that just happened to be local, but I knew that that hospital actually focused heavily on IT. They did a wonderful job with dealing with my, you know, taking my appendix out. But beyond that, they had a lot of different things at the time that in most hospitals you would think were cutting edge. And I'm not going to get into that. What I'm going to get into is that same study that turned out with the 10-point increase on a scale of 100 to 100 as far as how good the information technology department was. With each 10-point increase, there was a 15% drop in deaths. And they tracked this. This wasn't a small study. This was 167,000 patients over the age of 50. And at the time of the study, only about a third of those hospitals had computerized order entry and management systems. Okay, so judging by these results, we can look at how computers and technology had a dramatic impact on how well the hospitals performed their most basic function, medicine, keeping us alive. Now, we translate that to the business place. We translate that, and I've done that a few times, but let's really break this down to brass tacks. If your bosses are ignoring, if your coworkers are ignoring information technology, this would be my suggestion. Don't plan on the business being around for much longer. Now, there are exceptions. There are always going to be exceptions. There are a few companies out there, a few small mom and pop companies that manage to make do just fine because they're doing whatever it is that they're doing, something small, something simple, and they've done it right for so long that they can't mess it up. But even then, computers and technology can help them too. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, otherwise known as TSMC, is the most important company in the world today. The foundry produces cutting-edge chips for top tech firms such as Apple, MediaTek, AMD, Intel, and others. Taiwan Semiconductor and Samsung Foundry are currently turning out components using their 5-nanometer process nodes, although both are facing delays for their 3-nanometer process nodes. China is looking to become self-sourcing when it comes to chips. But there is a problem. The country's leading foundry, Semiconductor Manufacturing International Corporation, which is on the mainland, SMIC, isn't close to having the technology that would allow it to produce 5-nanometer chips, let alone 3-nanometer chips. And part of the reason is that the United States is blocking the foundry from receiving an extreme ultraviolet photolithography machine that is used to etch very fine circuitry designs on the wafers that becomes chips. ASML Holding is a Dutch multinational company specializing in development and manufacturing of photolithography systems. Currently, it is the largest supplier of photolithography systems, primarily for the semiconductor industry. The company manufactures machines for the production of integrated circuits. However, 91% of SMIC's second quarter 2020 revenue came from mature nodes such as 40 nanometers and 45 nanometers, which are considered to be legacy chip systems. SMIC did purchase an electroviolet machine from industry leader ASML in 2018, but hasn't received it, forcing the foundry to use deep ultraviolet lithography. This lessens the company's chances of catching up with the process leaders, although it might not matter right now. During last year's second quarter, nearly 91% of SMIC's revenue came from older tech, meaning 40 nanometers and 45 nanometers and up, with only 9.1% of the quarter's wafer revenue came from 28 nanometer and 14 nanometer nodes, which is also considered legacy, and the 28 nanometer node was more popular than the 14 nanometer. Huawei Kirin, the 710A unit, is built by SMIC using the 14 nanometer process node. Last year, the U.S. changed an export rule so that any foundry using U.S. tech to produce chips can no longer ship these components to Huawei. The latter high silicon unit designed 5G chips for Huawei handsets that were manufactured by Taiwan Semiconductor. But the new U.S. export rule is forcing Huawei to use a 4G-only variant of the Snapdragon 888 on its latest flagship handset. China's government and tech firms don't want to rely on foundries in other countries, especially since the United States can block shipments of powerful high-end chips to Chinese manufacturers. SMIC is China's best hope for building a self-sufficient chip industry in the country. SMIC is an important supplier for several Chinese chip designers as well as U.S. designer Qualcomm and reported record first half earnings this year. Nikkei Asia reports that today SMIC announced that it will build a $9 billion fab in Shanghai to take on Taiwan Semiconductor, which, by the way, is a Taiwanese company. Right now, there is a chip shortage that is working its way from automobile manufacturers to smartphone manufacturers, and it will take some time to get a new facility up and running. SMIC will go toe-to-toe with Taiwan Semiconductor over the 20-nanometer process nodes used for Wi-Fi chips, image sensors, and more. The chips that will be made at SMIC's new factory will use the 28-nanometer process node, which means that these will not be advanced chips. However, they will be useful in the production of Wi-Fi chips, image sensors, microcontrollers, and more. And SMIC will be going up against Taiwan Semiconductor, which announced this year's plans to expand its 20-nanometer production in Nanjing, China, to cover local demand. When Taiwan Semiconductor and Samsung were at 5 nanometers, SMIC was stuck at 14 nanometers. In fact, it even used that process node to deliver Huawei's Kirin 710A last May. Because Huawei wouldn't be restricted from obtaining cutting-edge chips from the Chinese foundry, getting SMIC into Taiwan Semiconductor and Samsung territory when it comes to process node 5 nanometers could go a long ways toward revitalizing Huawei. SMIC's N+1 node has been called 8 nanometers or an early version of Foundry's 7-nanometer process node. Last year, the company tapped out and tested the N+1 node. The result is a chip that can deliver up to a 20% boost in performance over its 14-nanometer process node, with as much as a 57% decrease in power consumption and a 2.7 times increase in transistor density, although not for all transistor structures. But the 20% power boost is not enough for high-end devices, leaving SMIC pushing the N+1 chips for low-power and low-price devices. And as you can see from all this, China's sword-rattling over Taiwan Semiconductor is a centerpiece why we have a chip shortage and where the fight is going to be over in the near term and the long term. The return to work in the office. As of late August, 66% of organizations are delaying office reopenings due to COVID variants, according to a Gartner survey of 238 executive leaders. The New York Times found that 45% of workers today want to be in office full-time, compared with 31% who want to be remote full-time and 24% who want a hybrid arrangement. Google became the latest major company to announce another delay in its return to office plan, pushing its reopening date to January of next year. Most recently, the tech giant planned its return for October, which was a delay from September, which was a delay from July of this year. Companies including Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Starbucks already announced postponements with similar timelines, and more employers are expected to follow suit as the U.S. heads into the fall with the Delta variant spreading throughout much of the country. The series of delay announcements is a reminder that 18 months into the coronavirus pandemic, the future of the workplace is as uncertain as ever. Employers need to understand the logistics of how to bring employees back. How would they monitor employees' self-reported symptoms? Should they do temperature checks at the door? Was it even a good idea to ask about employees' vaccination status? Employers have taken a step back to even consider, can we afford the luxury of bringing our employees back into the workplace? Each day, the answer changes, which is creating analysis paralysis for employers. Now business leaders are trying to walk back return plans without dissolving them altogether. Even though the longer the pandemic goes on, the criteria for creating a safe space and culture for workers get harder. Many who've tried to set return dates are now kicking the can down the road. It's expensive, too. Each time a proposed return date gets pushed back, that changes the surveillance strategies or policies that may be required in the workplace, which can cost hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. There are financial and opportunity costs in the return of work in the office. As employers chase down solutions to an unending list of safety questions, the first thing employees have to do is look at the expense of trying to bring employees back. The first expense is surveillance, as in tracking who is and isn't vaccinated and keeping those records stored securely. Then for those who opt out of the shot or have a religious or medical exemption, employers will have to front the cost of regular COVID testing, whether that's on-site, at home, or through a third-party facility. They might have to factor in the cost of providing reasonable accommodations in the workplace for those who qualify and ask for them, such as personal protective equipment or modifying spaces to ensure social distancing. They could also need to invest in systems to keep unvaccinated and untested employees away from the workplace for some companies. And that means turning off employee badges every 24 hours they haven't updated their vaccination or negative test status. Then there are all of the non-tangible costs of shepherding employees through a messy return, loss of productivity, deterioration of trust, a negative association between workplace policies and their jobs. And finally, leaders must recognize that a premature return to work during the health outbreak could lead to employees getting sick with the virus. Some management consultants say that there are also risks in keeping employees home too long after offering the potential to return to offices, particularly regarding workers' mental health. Some research has drawn a connection between remote work during the pandemic to an increase in social isolation and overwork. Business leaders must be mindful of workers who don't have ideal home office setups or who thrive off in-person interactions. In many ways, business leaders are back at square one in determining how and when to bring employees back to shared spaces. But this time, they have to consider whether setting plans, scrapping them, or trying to start over again could cause employee turnover in today's tight labor market. As employers do everything they can to be as minimally disruptive as possible, they have to be keenly aware that their communications and being tightly lipped around return to work strategy until it is truly time to communicate. The last thing they want to do is make an announcement and then have to walk it back a week or two later. But staying quiet on a new plan could be just as disruptive to some workers, especially those who are parents who must plan childcare and are more likely to have health concerns around office reopenings. There must be a need to be as much transparency as possible, even if decisions aren't final. One way is to have a general time frame of when leaders will even go back to the drawing boards of their return, whether that's in the final quarter of the year or early next year. The important thing is to have continuing communications on scheduled dates on return to the office. Employees want to understand the rationale for decisions, and they also understand that the situation is really fluid. If employers could be authentic about that and communicate that in a clear and in a consistent way, that goes a long way with the employees.
Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on mental models and the limits of artificial intelligence. Thursday, September the 9th at 7 p.m. online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, September the 10th at 7 p.m. online virtual meeting via Zoom. Their website is limac.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on Thursday, September the 23rd at 6:45 p.m. It's Virtual Private Network. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Their website is bcug.com. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has a meeting on Friday, October the 1st at 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Their website is acgnj.org. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, October the 7th at 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Their website is wpcug.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.